Welcome to episode 429 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Bex Milnes. Bex returns to the podcast after first being on in episode 353. I'll let her introduce herself, but just briefly, the topics we discuss today are primarily centered around age group specific advice for training as well as racing performance, and we also have time for quite a few listener questions. And I want to thank everybody that's sending in listener questions, by the way. I do want to mention that briefly here at the top of the show, that you can always send in questions on any topic right to my email. You can find my email address in the episode description and the show notes on the website, and I keep track of all of these questions in a document that I might then later answer myself on an episode or ask of guests on the show. And I also put out requests for questions in Instagram stories on Scientific Triathlon HQ before interviewing a guest or recording specific Q&A episodes. So if you don't already follow us there, then that's another avenue to ask questions, and do give us a follow if you are on that platform. But now, before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. Their gels contain 30 or 90 grams of carbohydrate, making it really easy to carry and to keep track of fuel consumption. Their electrolytes come in different strengths so that you can match your sweat sodium content, which you can estimate for free on their website. And for longer rides, when you might want something to chew on, I really like their delicious chews as well. I've used the entire range of Precision Fuel and Hydration products for years, and I think they are fantastic. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. The great thing about the Zenate is that it is so versatile, so you can make it work to suit your swim-specific needs. For a lot of athletes, the primary need may be to work on technique, which the Zenate allows you to work on really efficiently with easier proprioception because you're above water. Whereas for others, it might be to improve force and power, which is also very easy and effective to do with the Zenate. Zenate have a great library of video-guided workouts that you can pick and choose from to find the ones that best suit your needs. You can try the Zenate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenatesinter.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Bex Milnes. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Bex. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's good to chat.
Yeah, definitely. As we said before, we keep missing each other. You're now in Mallorca. I'll be there in a couple of weeks. And before that, we had a similar situation in Lanzarote, I think. But I'm hopefully later on this season or next season that we will be in the same place at the same time. But let's start with a bit of an introduction to you for those listeners that may be newer and haven't heard you on the show before. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm primarily a triathlon coach, although I do work a little bit with ultra distance runners as well. I'm just starting to get into that a little bit more. But yeah, primarily a triathlon coach, coaching a range of age group and professional athletes who are primarily focusing on 70.3 and Ironman racing. I'm based in the UK in Loughborough, and live with my partner, who is also a professional triathlete called Nikki Bartlett. And yeah, we pretty much live and breathe triathlon. I previously to kind of doing what I do now, I've been involved in the sport for almost 20 years, which feels really old in saying that. But yeah, I come from a background of coaching power triathlon and draft legal ITU racing. So I'm just basically making my way around the sport and the various aspects of it.
Yeah, no, that's really a really good overview, and I would encourage listeners to go and listen to our first interview as well, where we talked about a number of things, but from memory, a lot of it was just your overall coaching philosophy, but especially around professional triathletes and then also para triathlon, which you were wrapping up your time in under British Triathlon's para triathlon system at that time. And so that's all there. I'll link to that in the show notes. But for today, the plan is to chat a bit more about age group training and racing. And let's start with maybe a general overview of thoughts on age group training and how to get the most out of training when combining that with a family, full-time job, and so on. And I'll let you start wherever you want, and then I'll start asking some follow-up questions probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the world of age group training is really complex, and I think that's been my biggest learning in kind of stepping into this side of coaching. I think regardless of whether you're trying to complete or compete, the demands of the sport are pretty high, and it requires very understanding loved ones and family and a support network to kind of do that on a sustained basis. I think in terms of your question in how to do it, or the ways where I've seen it done most effectively, it's quite a loaded question, and I feel like everybody kind of listens out for the silver bullet of do this and it'll save you 20% of training time, or it'll make you 20% better. And I think the truth is with endurance sport, and particularly triathlon, it's the age old consistency over long periods of time where success is rewarded. But some of the things which I've seen done really well that I believe have a real big impact, both in the short and long term, may sound a little bit wishy-washy, like a little bit cliche, but they really do make a difference if done well. And I think the first thing which I would say is and it sounds very simple, but really making sure you've got clarity on what it is you're trying to do. And that would always be my start point from an athlete standpoint, because I think when you have clarity, it provides you with the really important anchor that you come back to. And how I distinguish that is, say you take athlete A, they come to you and they say, I want to race an Ironman in July. And you go, okay, great, let's build a training plan around that. And then suddenly they start training, they get fitter, and all of a sudden the kind of goalposts begin to move in terms of what good looks like for them or what success looks like for them. And I think naturally over time you can become a little bit more invested and motivated by metrics, and the goalposts of what's set out as, I just want to complete an Ironman, suddenly shift to, I want to complete an Ironman and beat Timmy from the team and run quicker, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's quite easy to lose sight of just what success looks like. And that can often be the thief of joy and actually the progression that you have achieved. So I'd always be quite specific around what it is you're trying to do. Of course, that can shift and change and progress. But I think that having that anchor is really key. Because I think in having that, kind of the second thing that I would say is it allows you to really set out and periodize your year. And I know the term periodization has multiple meanings for multiple people, and sometimes we can get caught up in the terminology of it. But in my mind, it's just laying out principally, how are you going to get from where you are now to where you want to be? So yeah, if you take, it might be helpful to kind of have a bit of a case study as an example. But if you take a fairly standard example of an age group athlete, someone that's got a bit of triathlon history, looking to race sub 10:30 for an Ironman, and that would mean that it would be a 45 minute PB for what they've done over that distance before. They've been pretty consistent in training. They've got around 10 to 14 hours a week to train. They've got a full-time job, a family, etc. Then I would always, with that goal in mind, work back from the Ironman that they're trying to race at. So say that's July. I think I would definitely look at that in terms of three phases, and starting with the final phase, which is the final lead up to the Ironman. It's the Ironman specific work, and really you know that in those final couple of months leading into that race, May, June time, that's where you're going to be maxing out on training hours. It's where your kind of final specific work is going to be done. And I think with that, it means that things like socializing and maybe family commitments may need to take a back seat for that period of time. But I think if that's built on a foundation of working back where there is a bit more balance and there is a bit more priority on work or life or things outside of triathlon, it becomes much more sustainable to achieve and work on. Because I think the reality is you'd obviously need a phase to kind of build up to that final prep. But there are definitely times in the year where you can prioritize other things and you can kind of train for fun and it be a bit more of a general prep phase. And I think often the biggest mistake I see people make is they finish their season, they have an end of season break, they decide on their goals for the following year, they're super motivated by it and they do their best training in November. And then it kind of fizzles out because they've committed everything. Because they're super motivated, they don't have that balance, and then it kind of, all kind of falls to the side, and they lose sight of what they're doing. So I think the key bits have been really, really sure of what it is you're trying to do, and then build your plan in a timely manner to get yourself there.
Yeah. One part of that clarity is good goal setting, right? That's something that I think is often done in just in a 5-minute tram ride in the off season, and it should really be something that you put a lot more thought and effort into. That's an area where I think a lot of people maybe go wrong, and because you may have set a 45-minute PB this year, but if you're still in your third or fourth year in triathlon, you're still getting some pretty good gains, but they are going to start to slow down with every year, probably, as you get fitter and fitter and faster and faster. So it's not necessarily realistic to think that you're going to set another 45-minute PB, at least without maybe investing more in training or maybe equipment or whatever it might be. So having realistic goals, I think, is a huge part of that. And on the one hand, it can be, as you say, that you end up just chasing new goals, and you may be super consistent and motivated, but things are not in balance. But on the other hand, you might also set goals that are just way out of reach, and then you get demotivated when you have a setback and you realize that you're very far from those goals, and then that you let yourself be derailed by that setback, and because the goals are not realistic enough to keep you on track. That's another thing that I've seen quite frequently. So I think that's a specific area within that clarity that I would highlight, a good goal setting as a foundation for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And not being afraid to share it. I think coming back to that first point that I made, to do this sport where you have a full-time job and a family potentially, you need the support of many around you. And I think being able to share your goals and that kind of be agreed is also a really important step. Because I think there's a lot going on in people's lives generally, and being able to prioritize and make just good decisions is really key. I think decision making is fundamental, and not being driven by guilt or feeling that more is better. It's important to be able to kind of consider the whole life picture, rather than being, I think triathlon is a sport that can generally draw you in to be very like tunnel visioned, insular and focused on the day to day. I think being able to kind of frequently step out of that is also important.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any good examples for how people might be able to get that support or that buy-in from their family in a good way, so that you also have to have that balance? It's not about convincing people that you can spend all your time doing triathlon, but getting good support from your family, basically, when they might not be triathletes and they might not really understand why it's so important to you to go and do these races and try to get faster each time, while you might be able to do those races, but on considerably less training than you're putting in.
Yeah, I think it's just about for me, it's about being open and just trying to explain as much as possible. Like for your average person, the sport is a bit mind-boggling. Even you know, professional athletes in other sports will look at what age group athletes do and the volumes that they train and think that they're mad. So, you know, I think it's recognizing that it is quite a unique sport in that way. But I think in terms of getting family on board and having that support, I think if you share what you're trying to do in an honest and authentic way that takes into account the family dynamic that you have and the aspirations of others, you know, your partner or children or whatever. I think the biggest thing is like being willing to show compromise, and find ways to kind of maximize your training, as much as possible. And kind of coming back to that bit around the planning, you will know the significant times in your year where triathlon may be more of a priority, but the times where it's not, then I think that's where, you know, using your work commute to train so that it gives you an extra hour on an evening, or if you've got a family trip planned, you're taking your bike and riding half of the way there and jumping in the car for the rest, you know, just ways in which you can be really time efficient. And I think if you're able to kind of share and plan, it allows you to feel much more relaxed as an athlete and know that you've got the support of family members. I think where I've seen things like become more stressful or struggle is when you kind of operating in a silo and it's kind of triathlon's one thing and family and work's another. But it's all like, it all links together. It's all connected. And I think it's only, when it's not done right, it's only you really that loses out at the end of the day, as an athlete. But I think I would say there's also such a range within the sport. You know, everybody tends to gravitate towards Ironman and 70.3, which is a great area of the sport. But there, you know, there's a whole level of kind of sprint and Olympic distance racing and other forms of racing that arguably do allow you a bit more time efficiency and allow you more time to do other things. And so I think it's being open, you know, open to everything and working out what works best around your family dynamic, and including the important people within that.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of examples of time efficiency there. Are there some other things that you've seen working well for finding time efficiency in your training? And I guess on the flip side of that as well, what are some common inefficiencies that in training that you might want to avoid if you want to get the most out of a limited time budget?
Yeah, I think what I've seen done really well is particularly work commutes or flexibility around work. I've got an athlete that basically cycles to work every day, and without having to worry too much, you know that that's a minimum of 6-7 hours of riding in a week, and so suddenly your weekends are much easier. So I think being as efficient as you can with time, you know, any time where you're kind of sat not unable to do anything, it's thinking a little bit outside the box. I think the times where I've seen real inefficiency is, dare I say it, is when people get really hung up on like specifics of sessions and data, and they're relying on technology, and all of a sudden you kind of come in from work, you've got an hour window to do a session and Zwift's not working, and then you've wasted 20 minutes trying to get that working. Like they're the times where, like personally, I just go, just crack on with the session, get a stopwatch and go and try and minimize that, you know, that time lost to faffing about as much as possible. Plan it, you know, things like planning a really good nutrition routine and food in your day are also really important. And although that's not training, like a direct result of training, but if you can plan ahead and think what sessions you've got coming up, where they're going to fit in your day, then where you fuel is an important part of that. And so if you can be eating whilst you're commuting or whatever, so that it means when you get home, you don't have to fuel to train, that is also really useful. But yeah, you probably tell the way I think, it's all about planning. It's all, you know, and knowing what's realistic and figuring that out and what's not. I think one of the most valuable things for long-term consistency is like decision making and knowing when it's okay to make up a session or to basically adapt, like how you make decisions to adapt your training, because stuff happens, you know, there's traffic jams, there's, you know, childcare falls through, or you need to adjust something. And I think like being able to make a rational decision that isn't just fueled by trying to get green lights on training peaks is also important.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. There is a time to make up a session, and there are times when it's better to just lose it and let it be. And what about consistency that we started this discussion with? What are some things that derail consistency, and what are some things that facilitate long-term consistency?
It's a good question. I think in terms of what derails consistency, dare I say it, it's often comes down to like poor decision making alongside sometimes, you know, in some cases motivation. And what I mean by poor decision making is, you know, exactly that scenario that I gave previously of you've got a session to do, you finish work, you get stuck in traffic, and for whatever reason, you know, for that reason, you're unable to complete the session. So you then decide to get up 2 hours earlier the following morning to get that session done so that you haven't lost it. And that then results in less sleep, less recovery, and within the next kind of 14 days, you end up ill or you end up injured. It's decisions like that, which at the time seem really insignificant, and just kind of, oh, I can fit it in. There's all, you know, I can always do, you know, I can squeeze it in here or there. They're the times that really, I think, really compromise consistency. Sometimes it's a case of biting off more than you can chew, like coming back to our point earlier around goal setting, like being a bit over ambitious in what you think is achievable and then pushing too hard, too quickly, not being patient enough with training progressions. It's often, I'd say majority of the time in my experience, is often injury or illness that prevent consistency rather than a lack of motivation. That occasionally happens, but often that lack of motivation is a result of having misguided expectations of what success is, rather than I just can't be bothered to get out of bed today.
Yeah, absolutely. No, those are all great points. I think that with injury and illness and making the right decisions to avoid them, that's one of the most important responsibilities and roles for a coach. It's not the training plan. Of course, the training plan has importance, but it's probably not as important, especially for age groupers, as just being able to help take the right decision as often as possible. And nobody gets it right 100% of the time. But when you have some good experience and you can be a bit more objective than perhaps the person themselves in the moment, then you can usually help get a better likelihood of a smart decision that will basically cause you to have an issue later.
Yeah, and I think that's very much kind of one of the roles I see for myself from a coaching standpoint is, I think the more experienced an athlete becomes, the more I certainly want to encourage them to make those decisions. And it may start out as, I think whenever an athlete is texting you or messaging you to say, this has happened at work, I've got this session to do, what do you think? Then that's their way of saying they already know the answer to that because they're writing it out and they're asking you. And so often it's just kind of confirming what they're already thinking themselves and giving them the confidence to make that call, which is, don't worry about making that session up. You know, we can adjust training later in the week. And that's where, that's kind of it's most basic level. And I'd always encourage athletes to do that and be proactive. I'm super happy when I see someone comment on Training Peaks and say, oh, I've shifted this about because this has come up at work, or I need to go into the office today, or da da da. And they've kind of problem solved for themselves, because I know that is going to lead to a greater outcome long term than them relying on me to say it, or in the first instance, not even recognizing that could be a problem. And that's a learned process. But yeah, that's a definite kind of trainable essential, you know, that you have to be good at making decisions.
Yeah, yeah. What about recovery and fitting that into the schedule? So, and here I'm thinking especially about things like when to take an easy week, how to fit in rest days or easy days into the schedule. Do you have thoughts on the periodization in that in that sense, the micro cycles and mesocycles and how to structure them? Or is that, because you can see it two ways, right? And you hear both of those being used. One of them is that, well, especially as an age grouper, you might not have the time to really get to your physical limit so much. You're more limited by time than by physical capacity almost to do the training. So you just do consistent training basically, and every once in a while you will miss some training because something comes up, and then that's fine. There will be a physical rest day, even if it's not a mental rest day necessarily. But then on the other hand, with all of the stress from jobs, family, and so on, you could argue that there is a greater need to have rest days and easy weeks for age groupers and professional athletes. So what are your thoughts around this?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And it's really important. Again, it plays a massive part in that consistency piece. My stock answer with it is it depends. And I think it depends on a few different things. So I have some athletes that are very clear in, I need a rest day once a week because I just need that mental switch off and to know that I've got space in my week to recover and I don't have to think about training. And then I have, and that's one end of a spectrum. And then I have athletes at the other end of a spectrum who say, don't give me a rest day. I hate rest days. I feel really sluggish off the back of them. And I don't feel like they just make me more stressed. And I think, both approaches are absolutely fine. It's working out the best training formula that allows you to repeat week upon week without, with consistency. But I think it's really important to understand the demand of work and the demand of family life. Because that is included in my mind in the total load of the stress on an athlete. It's not just a case of training load in isolation and assuming that because they've got a recovery week from a training standpoint, that's translated into a more peaceful home life because, an easier week at home. Because often if you have what I find is if you put a recovery week in training, then home life goes mental because they've got, there's more time. So I think it's figuring out what each individual athlete's kind of week life looks like, and then making space and really understanding coming to work together to understand what recovery looks like, because for some athletes, kind of walking the dog and after work or before work is their form of recovery. It re-energizes them. For others, it's, you know, sat on the sofa doing absolutely nothing. I think that's probably the biggest difference between age group athletes and professional athletes is professional athletes are much better at sitting and doing nothing. And age group athletes, it's a constant compromise of kind of doing enough training to elicit a stimulus, a response, but then having the recovery after to be able to adapt to that response. And that's always what I try and reinforce is like adaptation happens in the recovery phase. So you kind of need to ensure that you're doing that and doing it well, but it's certainly not easy and probably the biggest area of compromise that I see.
With those athletes that might not want a full rest day in a week, would you still plan one or two days that are much lighter in terms of volume and intensity?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would always, yeah, you have to have easier days in your week, for sure. Probably, to be honest, a minimum of 3 to 4 are generally where I'd pitch like aerobic easy days. We'll try and disguise a rest day with like just having S&C on that day. And so it still allows the athlete to feel like they're doing something, but it's intended as rest. I think it's unrealistic to expect someone to be consistent and then never have a day off, or achieve the best they can and never have a day off. You've got to be able to recover.
Yeah. And if you are on a limited time budget, like most age groupers, but not all. We're talking about here maybe, let's say, at the top end, 10 to 12 hours per week, and then going down a bit from there. How do you see distribution of swim, bike, and run volume in this context? And how does it differ from those select few that may be able to put a lot more time into their training?
Yeah, I think for the most part, unless you're in a very privileged position where you're either retired or don't have to work, I base most training prescription around what is most efficient. So, where you can get a maximum amount of training in through least amount of faff. So often, swimming is probably the most challenging one in a busy work schedule and life schedule, because it takes, for most people, you swim for an hour and it takes 2 hours out of your day. So it's like, for the most part, I would tend to lean more towards like a cycling, running heavy program for that reason, because I think, particularly when you're quite a distance out from racing, that may change as you get closer, or it does change as you get closer to racing, but you're just trying to acquire aerobic volume and volume of training, is the most important thing that's going to, kind of sustain a middle distance or an Ironman performance. And I think that's with that type of athlete that I'm working with, middle distance and Ironman, you know, for the most part in races, you just need to be really robust aerobically. And yes, if you're looking to maximize training, you can kind of maximize your physiological profile, and push thresholds on and that type of thing. But the timing of when you do that is also like, yeah, alongside volume is also really important. But if you are in a fortunate position where you're retired or you have, unlimited amount of time to train, then I would generally prescribe more from a place of performance than kind of trying to be efficient with time. And at that point, you know, when I say a place of performance, it's because I know you can guarantee recovery. that's kind of the balance, is if you know that you've got athletes that are able to kind of invest big hours in training and recover off the back of it, then I would more set a structure which is a bit more evenly distributed across swim, bike, run. But it also all depends on what they're trying to work towards and what they're trying to improve.
Yeah, but that makes total sense. And what about intensity? How does that play? Let's assume now that we're not in the immediate race specific preparation period in the last 6 weeks or so before a race, but we're a little bit farther out. Maybe we are 10 or 12 weeks out from a race. So kind of we already have some good training behind us. So in the later stages of what we might call general preparation, how do you see the role of intensity, and what are the factors that you consider when you put intensity into an age group athlete's program?
Yeah, I think, like, generally speaking, intensity is probably important to just quantify here. So when you're racing an Ironman, as an example, you're generally operating, if you're pretty well conditioned, you're generally operating around first thresholds, so kind of upper end of zone two, lower end of zone three. That is still very aerobic in its stimulus. You then have kind of second threshold, which a lot of people would associate with FTP on the bike, or hour power, or sprint standard distance race intensity. And that's where I kind of see the threshold or line of where the cost of those sessions is pretty high, and so you need to kind of build in recovery. The demand of an Ironman in the 70.3, for the most part, is kind of either in between that first and second threshold or around it. So that's where I tend to base the majority of the training. However, generally speaking, the further out from a race, kind of 12 weeks plus out from a race, I would look. If an athlete was limited by where their second threshold sat and their first threshold sat pretty close to it, and the limiting factor was their top end, I would put work in to shift that on. But you then need to create more recovery off the back of those sessions to create the adaptation. So generally, that would be coming from a slightly lower training volume with more rest and recovery. I think the closer you get, the longer those workouts become, the less intense they become. And actually, I think it's not always the case, but with well-conditioned athletes, it tends to be a lesser cost overall. You can have a bit of a higher volume with lower intensity work.
Mm. And would you ever, if you have an athlete that has a 1 hour window to get in a session on the turbo, for example, on a weekday evening, would you ever consider that as a, but they are still a relatively well-performing athlete, so maybe with some warm-up and some warm-down, getting in 45 minutes of work around LT1 or a bit higher isn't necessary? Do you consider that a bit like a sufficient stimulus, or would you then consider that with the time limitation that they have, you might push it a bit more closer to the second threshold, and just because of the nature of the time that they have available, or would you be happy enough to keep it closer to LT1 if that was the area that you wanted to focus on physiologically, but you, in an ideal world, you would have more time to do that than 1 hour?
Yeah, I think you can, like, in that specific scenario, you can still get some decent work at LT1. To me, it more comes back to, what are you trying to develop? Like, what's the limiting factor for that athlete? And yeah, I think what I see a lot of is I've got, like, that exact scenario. I've got an hour, therefore I'm time crunched, so I'm going to work as hard as I can for that hour because that will yield more results. It doesn't always work that way. But yeah, in that scenario, I think you can still get, you don't need to kind of just push on for pushing's sake, and you also need to consider what you've got the day after and what you've done the day before as well. Because if you just kind of assume you've got you know, you've got a cheeky 45 minutes and you want to make the best of it, the chances are you're screwing up what you're wanting to do the following day and the day after that, and et cetera. So yeah, I think it's the bit like around what's your limiting factor. You know, if I had an athlete that said, oh, I've got a spare hour to play with, I'd be thinking, right, okay, where do we struggle, like what do we struggle with? And so I'd be more inclined to go, okay, a cadence variation session, because like when you're racing on an undulating course, you lose momentum on at the crest of hills because you're not changing gears quick enough, or you haven't got the cadence to be able to maximize over the top of a hill. Or I'd be thinking, right, what aero drills can we put in there to ensure that like holding a TT position is more comfortable, rather than just thinking about it in terms of like physiological profile, because I think there's so much time you can save just through being smart with your training, rather than just trying to like smash eggs against the wall.
Yeah, that's a great point. Really great point. And let me see here. What about work travel? I'm sure you see this a lot. People have to go away for work for a few days, a week, and they might or might not have some time to train. They might or might not be able to, depending on where they're going, with safety of running outdoors. Cycling is probably not an option. How do you account for work travel? What do you do when that comes up?
I think, like for me, travel is one of the biggest stresses you can put on your body. Like particularly if you're having to fly or travel long distances. So actually from a training standpoint, that's pretty simple in my opinion. It's what are you able to do? And then programming accordingly for that. And then looking at the overall impacts pre-travel and post-travel and how you adjust training to kind of, it's not always a case of makeup, but just to ensure that you're maintaining, you're maintaining where you're at. But the big thing around travel is illness risk for me. So I always would advise anybody, if you have a lot of travel in your job, I would kind of go back to the good old days of COVID, and I would be hand sanitizer and mask. And as much as you may get weird looks, it's the, like, generally speaking, the athletes that I coach is the people that have extensive travel that struggle with that consistency piece the most. So yeah, I'd always prioritize, hygiene in busy areas, sleep, and just kind of build it into the training so that those busier times are less intensive from a training standpoint. Because if you just, in my experience, if you just try and battle through, you may get away with it for, you know, a week or so after, but it eventually catches up. I think travel is definitely a tough one.
Yeah, it does help a lot when you can plan ahead, when you know what travel you have coming up. But if things come up suddenly, then you're in a much tougher spot, because you couldn't time things correctly to make those days perhaps a natural recovery period that you would have planned in advance otherwise, if you had known about things earlier. So that's probably something that I would say, that if you have any control over that, trying to get the information as soon as possible is really useful. And what about things like strength training and any other, let's say, things outside of swimming, biking, and running? Primarily strength training, I think is the main one. Do you use that for age group athletes a lot, or do you try to save as much time as possible and make it as short and limited as possible to use the time for swimming, biking, and running?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's always strength training is always the one that drops off. If you have a decision to make around what session to do or what's prioritized, strength training is always the one that drops off first. For me, I see it depends on age, really, it from my standpoint. So I think for women who are approaching perimenopausal age, or for men who are aging, let's say into their 50s, you know, early 50s, then I would say up until that point, strength training is around injury prevention. So I definitely use it. And it's not necessarily for every athlete that I coach, but those where we know there are areas of vulnerability around injury, picking up niggles, asymmetries that compromise technical aspects of how they run or how they ride and manifest an injury, then I would definitely look to either prescribe myself or enlist the help of experts in that area to ensure that there's an S&C plan that targets those areas, so that again we're not compromising consistency. However, I think where, like as I mentioned, those two kind of life moments with women, perimenopausal women, and men that are kind of into the 50s, I see strength training as being more important, and that's not necessarily directly linked to triathlon performance, but more from a like just general health standpoint as you're getting older. I think lifting heavy at those ages is really important to retain, and it for the most part will help. It certainly won't do any harm to your training as long as you're doing it consistently, but I think the role it plays in how you then kind of work your way through later life is really important, and I think there's more and more research coming out to support that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something we talked about a bit over email, that you wanted to chat a bit about the effect of perimenopause on performance and its influence on training as well. So maybe this is a good segue into that topic. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I preface it by saying I'm no expert in this area, but I'm certainly, it certainly kind of becomes more and more prevalent. And I coach, perhaps unsurprisingly, a majority of female athletes. So this has become an education for me over the last year or so, that, yeah, I'm kind of astounded that the lack of information that is out there. But I think perhaps the hardest time is really in identifying the symptoms of being perimenopausal, because a lot of the symptoms that women experience are easily explained through just the wear and tear of endurance training. And so I think from a coaching standpoint, if you're working with females who are kind of in, you know, approaching mid 40s and later, then it's really important to just be in tune and listen to kind of their feedback around sessions and stuff, because that kind of chronic, like just feeling a bit tired or lethargic or not feeling quite mentally switched on, having a bit of brain fog, as some might describe, having irregular periods or like heightened stress, emotional stress, you know, all of those things, I think many women would go, yeah, that's just me in a heavy training block. But often that can also be a sign of reaching perimenopause and your body undergoing hormonal changes. And so, yeah, I think, like I say, that the kind of resources out there, particularly around how to train through that, is not that easy to come by. And I think if anybody is experiencing those types of symptoms, then the first port of call that I would advise is going to your GP. And they may not be the best initially at picking up, but I think if you kind of go in, explain your symptoms, and ask for bloods doing, then they'll be able to kind of confirm whether or not that is happening for you. But yeah, I think the biggest thing I've noticed in the athletes that I coach is like the diagnosis side of things is really tricky. Because actually is it happening? Is it not? And then it's the decision around treatment or whether you kind of have hormone replacement therapy or not, HRT. And there's a whole load of misinformation around that. And that also kind of impacts training as well and your general kind of day-to-day feeling. And I think overall, the biggest thing that all of this impacts is just the level of self-confidence. And I think that is then a big struggle for people who, or for women who have maybe relied upon their sport giving them self-confidence and placing, you know, value and things like that on themselves and being, you know, being really good. And then all of a sudden their kind of performance maybe starts to decline, or they can't hit the sessions that they once could, or they can't tolerate the volume that they once could. And the immediate response, I think, with a lot of females is it me? You know, why me? What am I doing wrong? And yeah, it often is easily explained once you seek medical help. But I just think it's not that widely spoken about. Although to be fair, there is a great resource and education website that I refer a lot of my athletes to, which is called thewellhq.com. And I think it's three women that have set up that website as an educational resource, which is they're all highly qualified women, experts working in this area, and not just perimenopause and menopause, but a whole range of women's health and sport things. And yeah, I think more work in that space and more resources and education is really important.
Did you say wellhq.com?
Yeah.
Okay.
The wellhq.com.
Okay, we'll put that in the show notes. Yeah, that's good. And if you have, assuming you have the proper diagnosis, have you found any patterns in adjustments that you may need to do in training to accommodate those changes that the body is undergoing?
Yeah, I think so. I've had a couple of athletes that have opted to use HRT, and it takes a little bit of adjusting too for some, but with the few that I've worked with, it's almost been like an instant change from being, you know, really out of sorts, don't understand why they're feeling so low, both emotionally and kind of from an energy availability standpoint. And then it's almost like, oh, I'm back to my old self. And so actually, from a training prescription standpoint, that becomes quite easy because, you know, the hormone balance is restored, and therefore you can kind of continue to train because, you know, the athlete is feeling more like themselves again. It's more, it's trickier to manage in that kind of either undiagnosed or unmedicated stage. You know, so it's personal choice, and some athletes may choose not to go down the HRT route, which is absolutely fine. And I think it's at that point that you need to become a lot more in tune with like how they're feeling day to day, energy availability, sleep quality, all of that type of stuff, because you will most likely need to be really adaptable from a training standpoint. So yeah.
Yep, that makes sense. And going back to one final question on general age group training. So what would you say are the most common training mistakes that you see age group athletes do and how to avoid them?
Yeah, I think actually one that I'm seeing pretty commonly at the moment is underfueling. And I don't mean like it's kind of underfueling over a prolonged period of time, which then results in just feeling suppressed in training. And it's quite a hard one to, or I found it quite challenging to spot. And it's not through kind of the intent of that being the case, but it's just merely kind of combining life, you know, family, work, training, always on to the next thing. And just subtly day by day, just slightly under fueling. And I think, it's, it's relatively easily remedied if, you know, if you kind of are aware of it and then put in place a plan to ensure that you're not under fueling. But I think that's one that yeah, I'm seeing more often, to be fair, is just kind of a consistent underfueling that compromises training. I think the other mistake people make is favoring high intensity over, you know, with this kind of feeling of being time crunched, so therefore I'll go smash out a session because that'll yield better results. And I think for a chunk of time that may pay off, that may work, but it's not always the best decision for, you know, we've kind of discussed it earlier on. But yeah, I think people feeling that just working harder is better is often misguided. And I think, yeah, probably, we're a sport which typically likes to, like, it's very open to new technology and data. And I think that's great because that has allowed the sport to grow and develop and for us to be kind of educated and have understanding over lots of different things. But I think the mistake I see people make is kind of being more guided by data to the detriment of how you're feeling. And I think there's place for both, and actually, like, data is great, but you also need to kind of give an equal weighting to just you know your personal gut feel on how you're feeling and how you're managing things. So yeah, that they would be the top ones.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that final one, the over reliance on data, that's actually one of the listener questions we have. So do you have any other, since it is a listener question, do you have any other things to add to that in about maybe technology and use of technology in general in the sport and over reliance on it, not just the main point there being that you should listen to your body and rely on your body's feeling, but are there any other points other than that you would make around data and technology?
I think that's the main one. I think it's just being clear about what you're using it for too. There are if you wanted, you could have a data point on pretty much everything that you do. But I would probably guess that for a lot of people, 90% of that data just kind of sits in Training Peaks. Unused. So, like, you know, if you are, it's great. The technology that is on the market at the moment, and it will only continue to get better, is brilliant. But just make sure that it has a purpose and it's been used in the way that is beneficial to you. I think, if you're kind of collecting for just because you can, then that's where it probably crosses a bit of a line. But yeah, I think the most important thing is knowing what you're collecting and why.
Yeah. So a couple of questions about racing and age group racing specifically. How would you say that the age group racing experience and age group racing dynamics influence things like the execution on that you would recommend, the strategy or the racing plan that you recommend for an age group athletes?
Yeah, I think I tend to look at these things a little bit, and it's determined a lot by the course, right? So I think the rolling swim start, which is in every race, I think, to my knowledge right now, is that's perhaps the most predictable thing, but I think it becomes incredibly hard from the start to know where you are in the race unless you've got a really experienced person on the tracker telling you, and that's both good and bad because it means you focus more on yourself and your performance, but it also means that you kind of don't really know what your competition are doing. But I think that's just a case of knowing it and then preparing for it. The bit which I think makes the biggest difference in age group racing is actually like bike course. And I think you have a range of, I think if it's a flat bike course, then you know that the racing is going to be more compact. There's going to be more people in kind of the same space, particularly if it's a multi-lap course, then you know that you're going to be overtaking slower athletes, as well as then navigating kind of the people that you're riding with. I think that becomes less of an issue on hillier courses. But then, of course, you've got the hills to get up. But I think my biggest learning is that particularly on the bike, you're constantly having to make decisions as to, you know, whether to pass, whether to inject more power than what you want to. And I think actually particularly if you're racing a flat course, multi-lap course, then the training that I would build around that would be very kind of stochastic in nature, because that's likely what's going to be demanded of you. And when I say stochastic, it's not like ITU style max sprints, but it's, you know, you are going to be pushing up to second threshold at points and repeating that. And there's only so many of those that you'd be able to do. So I think equipping athletes with the knowledge of, you know, you've got X amount of times that you can go up to this power output, and then you're going to compromise your run. But also being patient with when you choose to make those moves to pass people or groups or whatever it is also really, really important. And know that you basically want to be training your body to recover like slightly under what your target normalized power might be. But then also be able to kind of go above. I think from a running standpoint, it's then it can be, again, unless you've got someone experienced on the tracker, you're a bit into racing a little bit into the unknown, but that's okay. I think race dynamics impacts less on the run for the most part, unless it's a really busy course. But yeah, I'd say from a bike standpoint, it can be pretty tactical.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with planning for stochastic riding, even though it's a flat course, and yeah, basically building the training around the course and the dynamics. So just because it's flat doesn't mean that it's an erg mode type of training that you should be doing. What if we take an extreme example, comparing preparation for Kona versus Nice, the Ironman World Championships? How would you approach those two differently, not just the bike, but in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got two examples of like cracking world champs courses for very different reasons. If I was preparing an athlete for Kona, and I'm working on the assumption that they're European based, so we're factoring travel in there as well, the biggest considerations are like managing the conditions, the heat, managing the travel, managing yourself within the race. But I think Kona as a course is, like, if you just take the profile of the course, it's not all that demanding. You know, the swim, it's a sea swim, but it's generally not too rough. It's a pretty straightforward bike course, and it can be pretty windy, although we've not had a real windy Kona in quite some time. And the run is pretty straightforward, but the conditions are brutal. And when you factor that in with long haul travel as well. So for an athlete racing Kona, I would be certainly advising that they travel a minimum of 10 days out to the race. And ahead of that, I would be advising that they do a good 10 day heat preparation block. And that can be anything from time in a sauna, time in a hot bath, to what I would say is more beneficial is it doesn't have to be a heat chamber, but some form of environment that is hot, like is the same temperate conditions as Kona. I would be doing that ahead of travel. And in order to be able to tolerate that kind of work, you need to be in pretty good shape. Like you need to kind of be in in race, pretty much race shape by the time you're embarking on that heat preparation work. So I think for Kona, in my opinion, you need to be ready a little bit earlier and then get your body to adapt to the heat. And if I was being like, if it was afforded, I would also be doing another heat preparation block earlier in the summer, because I think, in my experience and what research shows is multiple heat exposures through the year, your body adapts better with each one that you do, in a similar way to altitude. So, yeah, I would generally be kind of, before you start kind of that specific Ironman prep for Kona, I'd be doing a heat prep block into that. And so, yeah, and then you're kind of looking at just smart equipment choices, like don't go in a black chai suit, don't wear a black helmet. And then from a racing standpoint, I'd be looking at cooling strategies for Kona. So I think although it's early in the morning, it's still really easy to overheat in the swim. And so I think like pacing strategy for the swim to ensure that you're swimming within yourself, and not getting carried away, but also pre-race, I would be ingesting cold ice, yeah, I'd be eating cold ice, to just kind of help that core temp stay cool. And then, yeah, I try. It's difficult on a course like Kona, but as many kind of ways of cooling yourself as possible, alongside a kind of pretty conservative race plan, I think is needed. Whereas you take Nice and the women's race, I think the men's race last year was reasonably hot. I think the women's race this year is slightly cool, like slightly later, so potential to be slightly cooler. But yeah, I mean, you've got a sea swim and it can be pretty choppy in Nice. You've got to get out of the surf to begin with. You're then onto like a mountainous bike course. And so, yeah, if I had an athlete racing Nice, I would be looking at what races this year in the lead up provide an alpine descent opportunity, or what training camps provide experience of alpine descending, because I think that is an important aspect of the race to capitalize on. And also not just the descending nature, but the climbing and knowing the intensities at which you can climb. So I'd be looking at that, alongside, to a lesser extent, probably still a bit of heat prep, because you could end up with a freak hot day and you would still need to kind of manage yourself within that. But yeah, I think both courses are pretty challenging and what you would want from a world championships.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are really good tips. And the final question on racing is, how do you approach tapering for that? And does it differ when you have somebody training maybe 8 to 10 hours per week versus somebody with significantly more time to train?
Does it differ? It depends. I think if you've got someone training 8 to 10 hours, it's also like understanding that cumulative life stress. I would also kind of incorporate in that taper. I'd say the biggest difference with tapers in, I think there's a natural kind of taper when you're traveling internationally to races, because there are unavoidable like commitments in your race week that just naturally provide opportunity to recover. And when I say recover, not like they stop you from training. So flying out to the race, you know, or that day is often pretty much a write off. Like testing the, you know, all of that type of thing. So I think actually taper for me is more by virtue of the circumstance rather than like really being able to maximize the perfect taper if you had the opportunity to do so. Because like I say, I think unless you're in a fortunate position where the race is out, you know, pretty much at your front door, you don't really have much control over what you do. So you're kind of building in recovery around the bits which are removable. I think what I would say is depending on the type of athlete that you are, and I mean more kind of like from a physiological standpoint, I tend to find people that are naturally more punchy, more anaerobic in their capacity, respond much better to a traditional taper. And by that, I mean like a general progressive reduction in intensity and training volume leading them to race day. Whereas more kind of diesel engines, athletes that lack range in terms of kind of top end, I think you have to be more careful with them, particularly around those immovable objects of travel, because it can be very easy for them to switch off. And so if I'm working with, and when I say switch off, it's not that they're switching off and they just can't be bothered, but physically they just feel sluggish because they've rested. And so typically I would try and rest them a little bit earlier out, kind of 10 days, build in some like proper robust recovery, and then build them up a little bit into travel whilst being mindful of the fact that they need like a good immunity going into the flight. So you don't want to kind of deplete them completely. But then those kind of few days out from the race, I would give them a little bit more intensity, just to switch them back on again. So they're not feeling sluggish and like it takes them a few hours to get into the race.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, and definitely something that I've seen as well. And I think a lot of athletes are doing it in the pro field, especially if you're looking at what some people are doing. I think that compared to 5 years ago, there's a trend for a lot of athletes that are a lot of them are obviously more aerobically gifted, given that they're doing long distance triathlon, that tending to do bigger volume and some solid work in all the way up until race day, basically.
Yeah, I think for those kind of athletes, it's very rare. Like as long as they're fueled and they're sleeping well, and that, you know, you're probably going to do more damage in tapering them too much than you are in not resting them enough, because that's just kind of, you know, for those athletes, you could probably say go race tomorrow and they do a pretty good job. Much better than if you took like a more kind of anaerobic athlete and said go race tomorrow, like the difference would be pretty significant, I think. So yeah.
Actually, let's do one more race question, which is the most common mistakes that age group athletes make in their racing execution, which can include the final few days leading into the race, so the preparation as well.
Yeah, to be honest, I think that's where I see the most mistakes made is before the race rather than necessarily during. And I think people are quite, generally athletes are really happy to invest so much time in training, but they will not fully consider the days leading in. And so some of the things that I see are people, and sometimes it's unavoidable circumstance, but where you can, if you're targeting a really important race, I would be, you know, certainly giving yourselves, you know, good 3-4 days ahead of the race to travel, settle in, maybe recce some of the course, and then race. Like I said, I know it's not attainable for every single race, but if you have a real key race, then I think that like just knowing the course, being settled in an environment and kind of distancing the travel from the race is really helpful. Just basic stuff like bikes, like bike maintenance. It sounds really simple, but yeah, the amount of people that I see kind of travel with bikes and they haven't had it serviced or checked before they travel, and I just think people invest so much time in training, and if you get a mechanical on a race course because you haven't had like taken due diligence with just making sure it works okay, then that's just like, it's just so sad to see. So I think just being really thorough with checking your tires, making sure you've got a fresh chain, like making sure your bike's been serviced and built properly, you know, all of those things. And then I think the other kind of main mistake pre-race that I see is underfueling. And that can often come as a consequence of being really busy, you know, sorting out the logistics of the race. Or sometimes it can be underfueling because you don't want to feel like heavy in your stomach before the race, and so you want it to kind of feel good to go. And I know a lot of people that kind of find that a real struggle to get enough calories or carbohydrate in pre-race. But I think the days leading in, if you're not fueling and you're not kind of if you're underfueled, then you're going to compromise your performance as well. So I think if you struggle to get calories in through food, just, you know, things like high carb drink or whatever way, but just get the fuel in, because that's pretty critical. In race mistakes, I think for the most part, it's not anticipated. Like, some, for the most part, the bits that I see is not anticipating the race dynamic that's in front of them. So, you know, to take, for example, what we discussed earlier, that the nature of a flat course, you'd assume it's just sit at a consistent power, and then people get out on the bike course and it's busy and they're overwhelmed by the decisions that they have to make, whether to overtake, whether to stay. They've got people coming past them in packs and they get frustrated, but, you know, all of that. And then they either just get really angry and ride too hard, or they become disillusioned with it and think, sod it. I think, like, just being prepared for the race dynamic that you're going into, and just being clear on your race plan and not deviating too far away from that.
Yeah, no, those are all great points. I think with the fueling leading into the race, one mistake that I see is that people, they start it too late, basically only considering the day before the race, but then backloading it. So having kind of a normal breakfast and then starting to increase the amounts for lunch, and then realizing that they're on the back foot and now you need to have a massive dinner, and then you're not going to feel good. And then the next time you race, you have that experience in mind. So you go lighter again. But so for me, the solution is that you, 2 days before the race, you make sure that you fuel really well. And as you say, you can use liquid carbohydrates. I like a lot, like melted dextrin and Coke, basically, our go-tos. Yeah. And jam. And then lead, maybe all the way up until lunch the day before race. But after lunch the day before the race, then you can start tapering down and basically have a normal, what you would have on a normal day when you don't have a lot of training going on. So you're already done by that time, because anyway, it's going to take quite a long time to get that fuel into the muscles as muscle glycogen. So if you're relying on doing it from dinner the day before the race, then you're already too late. Same thing with breakfast on race day.
Yeah, and particularly if you're already in calorie deficit from the days before, you're just kind of, you're just trying to make up. I think you're spot on. If you're solely fueling the day before, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. And then one more thing, you mentioned it earlier, but about efficiencies on the race course. So things like, how do you crest the hills? How do you, when do you stay in aero? How much can you stay in aero versus when do you really have to sit up? I think that's an area where a lot of people are just giving away a lot of time. Transitions is an obvious one.
Yeah.
That it seems like the clock stops, but it doesn't stop. So, and I think that, this is an area where a lot of people can find a lot of time without having any improved fitness, but it just requires a lot of focus and consciousness on race day about what you're doing and how you want to execute your race.
Yeah, I think it's like the point you make around like being switched on and conscious of the decisions that you're making. That's one of the biggest challenges with an Ironman distance race, because it's such a long period of time. I think people often get caught up in, like, on the bike, that's where you spend the longest amount of time. They get caught up in power, when the most critical factor is speed. So, like, you want to be kind of mindful of power, mindful of your heart rate, but those technical sections, like when to be in the bars, when not to be, and, you know, all of that should be informed from your training and your understanding of, like, speed and how to carry that.
And I think that the power target is often made on a best case scenario, that this is the power that you can hold in an Ironman and still run on a day when all the stars align, basically. But then there's not enough flexibility, maybe to. It's always better to ride 20 watts easier, but then run 10 minutes faster, because you're not going to lose 10 minutes by riding 20 watts easier. I actually should probably do the math on that, but I'm pretty confident. but my point being that you can give up a bit of time. You can give up a bit of time on the bike that saves you a huge amount of energy, and the corresponding gain on the run versus over biking is asymmetrical. It is an outsized gain on the run, or put another way, it's an outsized loss on the run if you overbike compared to keeping it a little bit below your absolute maximum capacity.
And I think your race experience is far more positive if you're able to finish, even if you have marginally underbiked. You're not going to not get all the energy out that you know. You're not going to go as hard as you can. And I think the ability to finish strong on the run and to like feel in control of the run is a far better feeling to finish on than feeling like death and that you just want it to be over now.
Yeah, 100%. So let's move into some listener questions. Let's take these as not rapid fire necessarily, but kind of short. So the first one is top end training early in season or late in season? From Paul.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for your question, Paul. To me, it depends a little bit on what you're training for. So let's work on the assumption that by top end you mean above second threshold, and that you're training for a 70.3. For me, I would tend to do. Say you're training for an Ironman, I would tend to do that top end work at the start of the training process and kind of raise the aerobic ceiling as much as possible, and then slowly move into more specific Ironman work later into the season. But at the other end of the spectrum, if I was racing sprint or coaching a sprint or a standard distance athlete, that would be flipped. So I would do predominantly more aerobic work and actually more like real top end stuff, which you don't really need to tip into for Ironman and 70.3 stuff earlier on, and then build kind of your more traditional intensity second threshold work closer to racing. But it very much depends what you're training for.
Yep. And Sven asks, training considerations for age groupers 50 plus, I'm considering replacing some endurance work with strength training.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, Sven, a little bit on like your training history, so how many years you've acquired training for. But kind of based on what I said previously in the podcast, I would definitely advise strength training. And by strength training, I mean like lifting weights and pretty heavy weights and building that up. But yeah, I think there is a lot to be gained from that, not just from a triathlon standpoint, but from a kind of an aging standpoint as well. But I think if you're doing that work or you're starting that work, just be mindful that the recovery off the back of it is really important in order to allow for adaptation. So you may find that it's not just a case of swapping a session out for like swapping an hour easy ride for a strength session and assuming that that's all fine. You may also need to kind of create a bit more time for recovery off the back of that strength session as well, initially.
Yep. Then Alex asks, this one starts a bit specific, but I think we can tackle it in a general sense and it will be helpful for a lot of people because it's quite good. Should I keep rest durations between swim intervals, for example, 200s and 300s at threshold, as prescribed by my plan, even though I feel that I need more time to catch my breath? I started running during the pandemic and stopped smoking only a year ago. Please, and here comes the more general part that we can maybe answer. Please shed some light on when to clench your teeth and rest as little as prescribed, and when to interpret rests based on how you feel.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think for swimming in particular, in my opinion, rest is like the duration of rest is pretty important. And the reason for that is across all three disciplines, your heart rate sits lowest when swimming. And so the time to recover is shorter because your max heart rate is lower, if that makes sense. And so that's why rest intervals are, compared to bike and run, are quite a bit shorter from a swimming standpoint. My initial response to that would be, if it's threshold, and I would work on the basis of very general, if you're doing 100 reps, you're probably looking at 15 seconds rest at threshold, 200 reps, 20 seconds, 300 reps, 25 seconds, kind of like that's a very general work to rest ratio. But if it's in and around that, then I would say the best thing to do is slow down rather than increase your rest. And threshold in the pool, in terms of how to judge it, should generally feel about a 7 out of 10. At the start of a set, that may feel like a 6 and build to a 7, and by the end of the set, closer to an 8. But if you're struggling with the lack of rest, then I would try slowing down. But I'd also talk to your coach about it and get their opinion on what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I'll chime in here. I think that the RPE numbers that you mentioned there is really helpful, and is something that people should consider, because I think a lot of people just go basically too hard. It's not their actual threshold. It's not a sustainable intensity. And I think if you just do a classic 200, 400 CSS test, it will tend to often overestimate your threshold. So yeah, you can maybe, you can do that test, but maybe add 2 seconds per 100 to that and get a more realistic, because you don't have to be right at it, and the body doesn't work like that anyway. So if you're at 95%, you're a second or two below, then you're still getting a really good session. And it probably matters more that you get in your 2Ks worth of threshold swimming than that you do only 1.2k, but you do it at 1 or 2 seconds per 100 faster. But I also I will actually have a slightly different opinion on the rests, because I do think that you can benefit from having longer rests in swimming. I think a lot of people find that the limiter is not their breathing and their cardiac system, but more so just the muscular endurance in their arms, and that's where I feel like having longer rests can be really helpful. So for me, I'm not afraid of giving work to rest ratios that are similar to biking and running if you need them. Of course, if you don't need them, then you can keep the rest shorter, as you said, Bex, but I would also not be afraid of going longer on the rests. But that said, I think for most athletes, they do tend to swim threshold swims too fast. So that's probably the first thing I would look into.
Yeah.
Then we have Michelle is asking about using the Swift ramp test versus the 20-minute test to set their FTP. And maybe you can answer that, but also discuss generally what tests protocols do you use in swimming, biking, and running with age groupers.
Yeah, I mean, I've never used the Swift ramp test, actually. So I'm unsure. But perhaps you know, does it?
It's a standard incremental test.
Does it pick out the data points? Do you know?
I think it takes 75% of the max 1 minute power. So yeah, I think that's the number. But it's a percentage of your max 1 minute power.
Got you. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think generally, if I speak generally with testing first, I think whatever you decide to do, and it doesn't need to be a kind of already commonly used test. It can be as simple as repeating a session that has meaning to you multiple times through a year. The biggest thing is that you're consistent with it. Because it's the repetition of the test where you get most information from, rather than a test in isolation. So that would be the first thing to say. I think generally with age group athletes, I tend to either use, so from a swimming standpoint, I would use a CSS test, but I would use a 200 max effort rest for 40 minutes and then an 800 max effort. Because I think that gives a better representation of kind of the more endurance capabilities of the athlete. From a bike standpoint, I tend to use either a straightforward 20-minute FTP test or a critical power test of a 3-minute, 40-minute rest and a 12-minute. And a little bit of that depends on what I'm trying to find out for the athlete as to which test I use. So with a critical power test, I'm more looking at their kind of W prime, their anaerobic capacity, and how that relates to their aerobic capacity. And from an FTP test, I'm more looking at kind of like just basically working out the percentage that 95% of the power that they hold. But I think with the bike side of things, I always then kind of back up the validation of that with a structured, like a structured session. So I think, you know, if I've done an FTP test and it's chucked out a number that suggests you should be able to, you know, have an FTP of 300 watts, then I would follow that up with, you know, once they're recovered and stuff, but with a session of between 4 and 5 lots of 10 minutes with 3 minutes recovery at that FTP. And I'll know pretty quickly if it was a valid test or not, because what I find is there's learning in how to do the test as well that takes place. So if an athlete can't complete that, then I know we've got some serious work to do around kind of second threshold robustness or FTP robustness. If an athlete kind of gets through it and they're it's been a challenging set and they're kind of pretty sure they couldn't do another rep, then I know that it's about right. If an athlete gets through it and they're like, yeah, it was okay, I was fine, then I know that they've probably undercooked their FTP test a bit. So I try to use like consistent sessions that validate the bike test, because most people don't have access to a lab, and I'm not a fan of unless we're really trying to explore a performance problem, I'm not a fan of people having to incur more cost than necessary. From a run standpoint, to be honest, I rely mostly on run races or repetition of a session. So quite often I'll say, you know, go race a park run or go race a half marathon. And I think for the majority of people, that's a really good way of benchmarking where things are at.
Yeah, no, I'm very similar in all of those things, really. Just one more comment about this: the ramp test versus a 20-minute test. I think that the ramp test is a good test if you want, for example, if you have an early season VO2 max focused period, because it will pick up on improvements in your VO2 max, but it won't be really sensitive to changes in your thresholds. And so for that, the 20-minute test would be much better. Although I do slightly prefer critical power, so like a 3-minute and a 12-minute, like you described. But I also, yeah, the 20-minute test is pretty good as well, I think. So, and it will, if your 20-minute power goes up, then depending on the training you've done, but for most triathletes, it means that your threshold has gone up. So for assessing your threshold, for sure, the 20-minute test is the one to go with, not the ramp test, because the ramp test is not a bad test, but it's not for threshold assessment, I don't think. And then the next question, what advice do you have for athletes going through tough times? That's a hard one.
Yeah, it is hard, because it's hard to know the context behind that. I think the biggest thing, which is quite general, but is just sharing how you're feeling with people that you trust. And trying, like, I think often just talking about why things are tough, in itself becomes like a bit of a reliever. And often I think if you like confide in the right person, then you often kind of find the answers yourself just through articulating and talking. I think if you can have someone that's just good at listening, then that's often a good way to work through tough times. But I think also just like having that conversation with yourself, just trying to understand, what's causing things to be tough, and is there anything you can do to alleviate that. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. But yeah, sharing it and trying to understand what's the root of you feeling the way you're feeling, I think are two important bits.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe triathlon has to take a back seat, depending on what you're going through, and being okay with that, having self-compassion. Frank asks, what to do when you're tired and don't feel like training, or you have a headache, or you feel sleepy, etc.
Yeah. I think for the most part, it's yeah, pretty simple in, you know, rest until you feel motivated or ready again to train. The reason I'm kind of stumbling or hesitating a little bit is, again, the context of that is a little bit lacking. But I think if you're consistently feeling that, if you're consistently, you know, having periods of time where you really don't want to train, and it's more of a normal occurrence than a want to train, then I think you have to, you know, look a little bit deeper and try and kind of reignite and re-understand why you're doing what you're doing. If it's just the general, I feel really tired and sleepy today and I don't feel like training, then don't train unless, like, that's, yeah, unless you kind of know you're being a bit soft on yourself. But for the most part, for triathletes, I'd say don't train, because often people are quite demanding of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I think especially for athletes that are usually really good at being consistent and usually don't have problems with motivation, I think motivation can actually be a really good giveaway that if you have poor motivation right now, even if it's just for one day, that something is off in the stress balance, may not be training, but maybe work, life, or other things impacting. But I think that the more you normally have good motivation, the poor motivation on a given day is a sign to rest, basically.
I'd agree with that.
And then the final listener question is from Jack, who's asking you about your thoughts on the intensity of endurance training. So whether you should do more like easier aerobic work, like let's say zone one or zone two in a five zone model.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of covered this a little bit earlier, but I would say it depends a little bit what you're training for. I preface that with a lot of stuff, but on the whole, if we said right at the start of the podcast, consistency is king above anything. That's what you're trying to achieve. Your body is going to like you a lot more if you train more aerobically, because it copes with those demands better on the whole. It's less stress on the body. So I would always tend, like, I think in terms of what you're trying to develop from an endurance standpoint, whether that be metabolically or at muscular level or whatever that is, those gains tend to come through zone two and below training. So the more time you acquire there, the better route to long-term success.
I think the question here is if you have a preference between, if we are assuming that this is like the big chunk of an athlete's training that is in those low intensity zones, zone one and zone two, but is there a do you have a preference, or maybe, and it might depend on the periodization and so on and the race, but is most of that training specified to be in zone two, or is it just wherever you feel like, or is it specified to be zone one to really save energy for the maybe the harder sessions?
I'd say it depends a little bit on the type of athlete that you are. I think typically more diesel type engines can operate at zone two and that not take too much, whereas I think for a more fast twitch anaerobic athlete, you probably want to be operating at a lower end of zone two/zone one in order to kind of promote recovery just allow for general adaptation. I think they're probably the key bits, really.
Yeah. All right, and that's it for the listener questions and all other questions for today. Is there anything else that you've been thinking about? Any other topics we should discuss?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered quite a bit there.
All right, great. And where can listeners follow you?
Generally, like on Instagram is the best place. So Bex Milnes Coaching on Instagram, and yeah, you'll see what we're up to on there.
Great. All right. Well, good luck with the season. Racing starting soon, so exciting times. And yeah, hope to catch up with you again soon.
Yeah, hopefully we get to meet in person. Right.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. I have linked to Bex's previous appearance on the show, which was in episode 353, as well as her Instagram and website, and also the resource she mentioned about women's health courses for coaches, teachers, and trainers, which is called the Well HQ. Seems really interesting, and I will have a look at that for sure. Some personal takeaways and thoughts after doing this interview is firstly, the importance of good preparation and organization during race week or the final few days before a race for having a good performance on race day. And especially if you travel and travel overseas to the race, the more you're just winging it, the less that you set yourself up for success on race day, because what you do in the days before does have a big impact on race day performance. This applies to nutrition that we discussed in some detail, but you may also consider factors like rest and sleep opportunity, time on feet, stress, and lots more. If you're not organized and planning these things in advance, then one or more of these factors may turn out to have a significant negative impact on your race day performance. Then the second point to highlight is the importance of considering total life stress in your training equation. I think we're all well past the point where this is news to anybody, but I do think that there's a gap between awareness and action. So many athletes might very much agree with this in theory, but have a hard time adjusting for these changes in life stress in practice when reality does hit. I think most people have their own typical level of total stress, and over time, you end up finding a training routine that works quite well with that total stress. But where you have to be really aware and be conscious and consider making changes and making decisions is when you have any changes in that level of total stress. That's where you have to be really careful and make smart decisions, which leads us to the final point, decision making. This one is easy enough to understand, decision making as a key part of a good training process. But I have some thoughts on how you improve your decision-making in the context of training. Specifically, three things that I think can help most people is number one, by making active decisions, not passive ones. So for example, if you feel a niggle coming on during a hard run, let's say you start to feel some pain in your hamstring, just because this is a problem that I had and have every once in a while, then you need to instantly become aware that this is the point where you make an active decision. Do you continue the workout or do you stop right now? And don't let it just be there in the background and trying to ignore it, because then you're kind of making a passive decision to continue without taking action. And that's not going to help you. You can make the active decision to continue the workout if you think that the risk is not very big, but at least then that is an active decision. So I think that that's a really important one, to not let yourself fall into the situation of having to make passive decisions rather than active ones. The second key thing for better decision making is to take ownership of your decisions. So basically take away bad luck from your vocabulary. Of course, bad luck does exist. There's no denying that. But there are usually things that we can do to minimize the risk of bad luck. And an example, again, from my personal experience is bike crashes. I had a couple of bike crashes last autumn. And at least one of them, it would be very easy to say that was just 100% bad luck, nothing I could have done about it. But if I really think about things, there are definitely learnings and things that I could have done to minimize that risk, not to say that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but also things, more importantly, to minimize that the risk of that kind of crash happening in the future. So so basically, that is something that I can do every ride that I go out on, take ownership of my own decisions, how I do things to minimize the risk of that kind of crash happening again, even though it may be, a lot of it may be seen as bad luck, but there is always, yeah, basically the more ownership you take of your decisions, the better the position you put yourself in from not having setbacks of various kinds. And the third point here around decision making is to look back at your successes and setbacks and analyze which key decisions led you to those points, whether they be positive successes or negative setbacks. But usually you can find some key decisions behind each of those that helped you, and that's always a good thing to do. Look back at what went well, what worked, and what did not go so well, what did not work, and then you can learn from that and take that with you going forward. So those are my key takeaways from the interview. If you have some comments, some takeaways on your part, then feel free to email me and let me know. I'm always happy to hear feedback and thoughts on the episodes. Now, a bit of promotion for our Scientific Triathlon coaching services. We recently got a review from Michael, not myself, from Michael in Australia. This was for one of our coaches. I'm going to change coach's name from whatever the name was to coach, because the point here isn't to highlight any individual coach, but just the type of work we all strive to do when we work with athletes individually. So Michael writes, "Coach's coaching is excellent. He's very hands-on. The training is individualized to me and my strengths and limiters, and it is adapted to fit my life circumstances. The communication is timely and responsive, and the coaching calls are great. I feel like coach is a partner in problem solving and someone I have in my corner to work through challenges." And end quote. So yeah, if you want to get the most out of your training, then I think that without a doubt, coaching is the way that you can get the farthest. You can get the most out of yourself by having somebody that can help you fine tune your training based on the countless factors that should be considered when you're really looking to find the optimal training for any individual. And one thing that I want to mention is that I've over the years come to understand that for somebody who has never been coached, or at least haven't been coached in the really individualized and communication-based approach that we do things, it can be quite difficult to understand how big a difference coaching can make until you really do it. So what I would just say is that if you're even curious in the slightest, get in touch with us and you can set up a free discovery call with one of our coaches and you can find out more and make an informed decision based on that. It is much easier to explain and get a feel for it when you have a conversation with a coach and you can discuss, and it's almost like a kickstart even though you haven't made a commitment or a decision yet regarding starting. So if you're not quite sure what coaching is about, that's an option that we have, and we encourage you to reach out and let us know if you're interested. Also, we don't have any startup costs and we don't have any minimum commitment terms, so there's not a lot to lose if you sign up but then decide that coaching isn't for you. So go and check out more information on scientifictriathlon.com, and please contact us if you have any questions. In the next episode of That Triathlon Show, we have Melanie McQuaid on. She's a great coach, and she's also the first athlete to have raced in the pro ranks in Kona at the age of 50, which she managed last year. So we will talk a little bit about that, but then first and foremost, we talk about a bunch of training-related questions. That will be out in a couple of weeks, although I don't have an exact date yet when I will release that episode. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimcare.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.